So this evening we're going to think about abortion and the right to life in general. So we will be talking about so-called infanticide, which is killing young children, infants, and also about euthanasia. I want to just remind you what I said last Tuesday, which was that as we do this, we need to remember the gospel and keep remembering the gospel that I make no assumptions, neither should you, about how any of these topics have interacted with any of you at any time in your past. In all that I'm trying to say, I'm trying to be careful to recognise that, to recognise that the gospel means that whatever we've been involved in the past, either sort of directly or indirectly or through family members or condoning it or whatever it was, all those things are part of what Christ died to forgive and redeem us from. So there may be things to repent of, but they're not things to live in the shadow of, like all the rest of our sin that we bring to the cross. So we need to remember the gospel in that sense. But again, to remind you that we need to remember the gospel in the sense that although this will seem quite hopeless this evening, again, and a little depressing if we just kind of observe society and think what's happening, we need to remember that the gospel can change lives, can transform people's lives, and actually has the power to transform whole societies. What is remarkable is that the society that the gospel was kind of born in, a culture that Jesus was born in pretty much, especially outside of Jerusalem and Judea, the Greek-Roman culture was very much like our culture. And there was promiscuity, lots of spontaneous, that's not the right word, but lots of sex outside of marriage, casual, that's the word I was looking for. There was paedophilia, there was homosexuality, there was abuse, there was abortion, there was infanticide, and although it's not particularly documented, there was probably euthanasia, although it probably wasn't so much of an issue because of the age people lived. So that's the society into which the gospel was born. And what is very encouraging is that the gospel transformed that society. Whatever bad stuff we can definitely say about the Holy Roman Empire and Roman Catholicism, you know, and whether Constantine really was a Christian, all that kind of stuff, actually, all the Christian values dramatically influenced the right to life, the rights of women, in a remarkable way. The beginning of hospitals and care for the poor and for the sick, all those things came out of Christianity. So it can transform society and societies, because it's done it in the past, and it does it in small ways within families sometimes, but it can do it for whole nations as well. So don't be alarmed or depressed thinking about this. I'm sure you've heard this, but it's a fun thing to know that when the sperm meets the egg, there is this flash of light, which you can get a bit too fanciful about, but it is a kind of a fun thing that actually happens and kind of signifies the creation of a new piece of DNA material that's unique. I think to a slightly lesser extent it happens in other animals too, so I'm not saying it's unique to humanity, but it's a kind of a marker, a kind of visual marker to say there's a new life beginning. And everyone agrees that new life begins then. But just as a question, there's a bit more interaction this evening, although you did interact quite a lot last week. What reasons might people use for that life that's started, what reasons might they use for it to be terminated, but at the same time not think they're killing someone? So assuming that most people would not want to kill another human being, so what reasons do people give? What answers do people give to that question?
To justify abortion.
Yes, that a life could be terminated that's just been created in the womb.
Well, I think it's a human being. I think it's just a bunch of cells.
Yeah. Okay, they could be saying that. Yes, they could be giving you utilitarian reasons that they don't want it. There are more.
They couldn't afford another baby.
They couldn't afford another baby. So another, practical reasons. They don't want it, they couldn't afford it.
Someone being raped.
It could be from someone being raped, yes. So it's unwanted in its origin.
It's the wrong sex.
It could be, that's another reason, terrible reason, but yeah, it's the wrong gender.
It could have Down syndrome.
It could be defective, yeah.
It's a genetic disorder.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
It's too early in my life, yeah. I want to live life.
Yeah.
Might be to do with shame. I don't want it to be, I don't want to be shamed. I don't want people to know what I've done. So that could be a reason. Just expanding on Shirley's answer, which was, we've kind of given the sort of practical answers, but the reason that people can live with that, so there could be all these, the reasons why, the ones, most of the ones you just said, but the reasons why in the person thinks that, or maybe they don't think that, but anything kind of add to that? The reason why the person rationalise it as not a murder.
It's very convenient.
Okay.
If you can put it in your mind like that, then you've dealt with it. It's in a little box all on its own. It doesn't exist really yet.
Okay.
I can't feel it.
Yeah.
There's no pain.
Yeah, depending on what stage, but no, there's maybe no pain. Cultural pressures?
Yes. The gender issue. Some societies want boys, not girls. And that's a big issue.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly a driver for abortion in Jesus' time. A massive driver for abortion. And certainly throwing babies off the cliff and so forth that were either defective or girls. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. 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 So the arguments are, I'm not sure, always articulated. You know, if you kind of queued up in an abortion clinic and said, okay, why are you doing it, you may get the utilitarian reasons, which are, you know, not the right time, wrong relationship, don't want it, haven't got any money, got five children already, whatever. So you might get the utilitarian arguments, but you may not get the sort of philosophical argument that says it's okay because, but most people have either had to go through a process of saying that, or sadly not, in which case when it's happened, that they then got to kind of live with the fact they perhaps didn't think through what had happened. Because I'm not sure everyone has kind of completely bought the whole kind of self argument, but the cultural pressure is that it's the done thing, it's a normal procedure, it's kind of like having a tooth out. It's in that sort of category of sort of painful and inconvenient, but it gets rid of a problem. So the cultural message, even if the person individually hasn't thought all that through, the cultural message is that it's both okay or more than that, actually positively to be encouraged if it's going to not be wanted, this child. It's kind of almost considered a mercy. That there's one thing you haven't mentioned in terms of the sort of what people might argue. It's a gender-related issue.
Oh, is it because it's a woman's right?
Yes, yes. So the argument would be basically, this is my body, and it's my right kind of what to do with it. So yeah, so those are some of the arguments, some of the reasons people might use. I've given you a bit of history. I know it's not, you can just look it up on the internet really, but just to put it there, 194,668 abortions in 2017. There's been 9 million since the Act of 1967, which is even currently, considering, you know, all the publicity about contraception and so forth, to prevent pregnancies, there's still one abortion in the country every 3 minutes, 20 every hour, 600 every working day. The vast majority, over 90%, are for what's called social reasons, not for defective, you know, babies that might have Down syndrome. That's quite a small proportion, or cleft palate or the wrong colour hair or whatever, but you're not allowed to do it for the wrong colour hair, but you might be one day. But those are a relatively small percentage. What I said there also is that medical abortions at home are now a significant proportion, meaning, do you know what a medical abortion is? What they call a medical abortion?
No, they give the pill.
Yeah. Pardon?
The morning after pill.
No, no, that's a contraceptive in sort of medical terms, even though it's not. But medical is, I suppose to put it, no, I won't put it crudely, but somebody I know who was having a miscarriage, it's the procedure they went through where you take a tablet at home, and that forces the fetus to abort. Sometimes a tablet, sometimes a little course of tablets, and then it causes the whole process. And so you to put it really crudely, you sort of wear something, you flush it down the toilet, that's the process. But you do it all at home, and it's more encouraged because obviously it's not so expensive and invasive for the patient. It's cheaper for the NHS, but there's less scrutiny.
By the time they get home, but in that in-between period, things could be quicker,
and
it was just
horrendous. So that's the kind of bare facts, the difficult facts. You probably know this as well, but it's probably worth just knowing again that the Abortion Act, when it was enacted in 1967, was actually intended to be restrictive and just to stop kind of backstreet abortions, but was intended to be only in limited circumstances, and with the whole kind of two doctor signatory, and there was supposed to be a reason. So I'm sure you've heard in the press recently, because of Southern Ireland, Republic of Ireland, making abortion legal, there's been a sort of possible campaign, well, there is a campaign going on, to make abortion legal in this country. You might think, well, it already is legal because it happens, but actually abortion is technically still illegal, and all the 1967 Act did was to kind of say it's not illegal in these cases, but fundamentally it's illegal. I said it right down there. It's kind of, I don't know what you'd call it. It gives you a feeling to read the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act, because you can go online, you can actually read the legislation, the actual wording. And it goes through various offences against a person. And it's very interesting in the light of personhood theory and everything else. But included in offence against a person is abortion. The giving of, it uses the expression, the giving of a pessary is explicitly in the law, against the law. And that hasn't been repealed. There's an assumption there that it is a life that's been taken away, and that's what the campaign is about, is actually repealing that in total. So not only would it be considered sort of technically never illegal, the campaign is also to make it much easier, so probably to the point where it's just an over-the-counter process, so the actual, not the morning after pill, but the pessary pill, the is pessary the right word? I think it is. Would be something you could maybe buy over the counter. You could probably buy them on the internet now.
So the Abortion Act recognises that the fetus is another person, what you're saying?
Well, no. The 1967 Abortion Act, I'm not sure whether it precisely does or it doesn't, but it was supposed to be restrictive and stop kind of dangerous abortions happening kind of outside of sort of normal medical processes. It's the Offences Against the Person Act that recognises that it's a person, that one in 1861.
By default, it means abortion if it's being permitted under those circumstances. It's saying the same thing, so I can see why they want to get rid of it.
Absolutely.
It's too close to home, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the kind of UK history of it. The rationale for abortion, like I just said, individuals might not have thought this through necessarily, who are involved, but the big philosophical kind of background to it is something to do with the person and when a person starts existing. There is pretty much no single biochemist, biologist, or anything else-ist, who who would deny that life begins at conception, in the sense that a viable potential new cluster of DNA, kind of unique, ready to form a human being. There's no dispute now that that is alive, and that it's a human organism, that it's a human being. So there's no dispute about that anymore. And there's no science that traces the existence of something changing biologically. It's obviously there is change, and the central nervous system appears, and you can do various things, but fundamentally nothing biologically changes. So that's agreed. So what you get is kind of bioethical philosophers who need to then provide some sort of cover. And whether you're a layperson, like you never thought about philosophy, or you're one of the philosophers, you basically got to get to a point where you say, this human being in me is not a person yet. That's basically the argument. This human being in me is not a person yet. And so we have no moral obligation to protect it until it becomes a person. That's the way the argument goes. All right, so far?
Yeah.
Again, as it says on the notes, and I was surprised at this, because I didn't quite know it actually, but James Wilson and Francis Crick, I knew this bit, discovered DNA, identified DNA chains, which, as you know, in a human being can kind of reach to the moon and back about 20 times or whatever. And Francis Crick would say that you actually have to wait, not just through pregnancy, but 2 or 3 days after a baby has been born, and for it to pass certain tests before it could qualify as being a person. Peter Singer, who's quoted in this book, who's an Australian, I think, philosopher, he's a kind of famous, or infamous, famous for being bad, atheist, and he says, kind of up to sort of 3 years old, you can use certain criteria to decide whether a child ought to live or not. It's true though. These are like mainstream people that now I'm not saying everyone in the country would think that, but this is argumentation that's been made, and actually it's completely logical. It's just it sounds a bit worse. But it's a completely reasonable, logical extension of terminating a child, a baby, a fetus, sorry, inside the womb.
In Old Testament times, Molech, the god of Molech, that was something all females were trying to go on, was I mean, they offered their babies and young children and their sacrifices. It's not new.
No.
In the sense of killing people of that age, I mean, that's horrific enough. But it's nothing new under the sun. The reasoning may be slightly different.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't
know. No, it's all good. Yeah.
There was a case in Northumberland as well. They sacrificed their children because they thought.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Wow.
And I think in the Inca era in South America, that was a child sacrifice thing went on in that period as well.
That's what it is. Makes any better at all, but it's for different reasons. I suppose it's that was a cultural slash.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that the idea of a child being killed is not new in that sense.
It's just interesting with Peter Singer, but what his criteria for doing that, because it just doesn't quite make sense.
Who came up with the idea of tests?
Well, I mean, these three that are quoted here, but others too have done that. And you can do tests within the womb as well and decide on sort of that basis. So I've just listed some of them that they weren't all said by one person, but kind of gathering together what people might say. So you could do the viability test.
Can I just ask something else then? Because I'm right that abortion is legal up to the time of birth in some circumstances.
Quite possibly, yeah. So I can't remember, yeah.
A baby who is near term can be aborted.
Yeah.
That doesn't bear thinking about either.
In the UK?
Sorry?
In the UK?
In the UK?
I think so, but I think it has to be on different medical circumstances.
But it is
I think in the US it's different again, as I'll mention in a minute. I think it can be much later in the US. But yeah. So some of the tests might be viability. That's a bit of an old-fashioned test now, in the sense before there was more kind of science. But viability would be, well, if it can't exist independently outside of the womb, if it's still dependent on the mother, then it can be aborted any time up to then. And that's probably the way that the current 24 weeks, is it? I can't remember. 26 weeks?
24
weeks. The current 24 weeks got set in that sort of babies could possibly survive from that point. That's probably the sort of viability test. There are others which might be a sensory test to say, well, as soon as this human being can feel pain, then they're a human being, so they're a person. So they've now suddenly inherited all these moral rights. Yeah, Philip?
I saw a video, I can't remember how many weeks old the fetus was.
Yes.
But they put a probe near the child and it responded all the time.
Absolutely, yeah, quite. There are other tests to do with cognitive function, which is to do with the cortex or the bits of the brain sufficiently being developed. You could do one to do with, has the central nervous system developed. There are some Christians who may sometimes argue about that, that I don't agree with them, but they might say, well, if there's no central nervous system, there's no kind of repository for the soul. So the person isn't a human being, kind of thing. There could be sentience, like awareness, which is related to sensory, but not that you can easily test it, but self-awareness. And you can certainly test a born baby for that, or a child for that. Sense of time is one else that was mentioned in what I was reading. So if you've got a sense of a kind of where you are and a sense of your kind of relationship with time in some way. I don't know quite how that became a test.
Do you have like a relationship with time?
I think it's not to do with knowing what the time is. I think it's knowing how we kind of move in time and space. I think it's that kind of awareness is what they're after. Communication is another one. Are they seeking to communicate? Yeah, could be another one. Or a desire to live. Now, you can see that some of these tests wouldn't be easy to apply to a baby, but you can see how these could be used to apply to an up to 3-year-old, say, and you can certainly see when we go on to the next thing, which is a very short section, when it comes to euthanasia, how you could apply these same tests. So you could say someone's in a vegetative state, someone's got severe dementia, they don't know who they are, where they are, they can't seem to feel pain anymore because they're falling over and laughing, they're not communicating anymore, they're not seeming to be receiving any information or giving any information. And before they got ill, they said they didn't want to live. So they're failing all these tests, so let's bump them off, would be the argument. Yes.
So these children up to 3 years old would have to have one of these, or is it any 3-year-old?
No, he would say a 3-year-old that fails the test. Yeah, he wouldn't just say...
So I thought when you first said it was like any 3-year-old.
Yeah.
I
think he said any 3-year-old that failed these tests and or didn't want to live. I don't think he said any 3-year-old because they're inconvenient. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. There's a complicated bit about species in which I didn't get you into. Right, it qualifies as a person. Da, da, da. Yeah, some proposed personhood emerges as a developing organism. Intelligence, self-awareness, self-control, sense of time, concern for others, communication, curiosity, neocortical function. I didn't do that one for you. Score too low for any measure, and Fletcher, who's another person mentioned, says you don't qualify as a person. I've seen some Peter Singer, but I can't find the actual one. Right. Francis Crick says, this is the actual quote, no newborn infant should be declared human until it's passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment. And if it fails these tests, it forfeits the right to life. Peter Singer says even a three-year-old is a grey case. That's what he actually says. He proposes discrimination on the basis of cortical function. That's what Peter Singer proposes, whatever that means. Well, you know what that means, brain function, but precisely what that means. What's the problem at a practical level? We can understand what's the problem at a moral level, but what's the problem at a practical level with these kind of tests?
They can be manipulated.
They could be manipulated.
They're just very hard to do.
They could be hard to do practically.
Boundaries around some of those things like awareness or cognitive function.
Do their best, but they're still. How do you ask a 3-year old their desire to live? Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, it's just people making excuses.
Yeah, so I think they're practically difficult. They, in the end, involve a social construct of personhood where society decides what is a person. Whether you could practically get a society to agree on that, which is why it all kind of happens rather haphazardly, and there isn't an agreed set of tests. There's just at the moment an agreed date after which abortion can't happen. So all these tests and stuff are around and being talked about, but actually there isn't any agreement, which is why we are where we are.
And obviously that was incredibly wrong.
Yes.
So it huge alarm bells, because, you know, trying to test the fetus, you don't know what you're doing in there. You know, they're probably, you know, said that they do, but you don't actually know what that, how that is affecting that fetus.
No, that's true. That's a good point. So the test itself may have some detrimental effect on the fetus.
So there's carbon dating, you know, lots of carbon dating and stuff. It's just all scientific stuff surrounding it, you know, how they think they can carbon date things back to years and all that kind of stuff. You think?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like so many,
These are in the States, but I'm sure there's lots more, but there's two cases, one which is in the book and one which I just heard on the radio recently. The one that's mentioned in the book is a famous case, I think I didn't write it down, but Fletcher versus somebody or somebody versus somebody. Anyway, a famous legal case, and a woman decided to have a baby aborted, but for some reason the baby was born alive. And then there was a whole legal case that went on for a while deciding whether that baby should be killed, and eventually it was killed because it was the woman's original wishes. So that's in the book. You can read about that. There's another case which was very harrowing. I just was listening to Radio 5 one evening, and this lady came on, and then I had to go and run downstairs and actually Google it and find out if it was true, and then I watched some videos of her. But there was basically a baby aborted, and it was put... it wasn't incinerated, it was put on some kind of a dump in the States somewhere. So it was in a kind of, you know, rubbish dump pile somewhere in the hospital. And someone later discovered that this baby was crying and actually rescued it. And this baby was eventually adopted. And this, you can Google it on the internet and you can find this lady who... obviously is now a grown woman and goes around sort of telling her story. Now, you could say, well, they're just kind of gruesome stories and they don't kind of prove the point, but in a way they do prove the point, that no one would advocate killing that person now, but fundamentally this person who was on the rubbish heap, but and people would have hesitated, although that legal case is contrary to that, would have hesitated to just strangle this baby they've just found on a rubbish heap, wouldn't they? But But just a few hours earlier, they would have been happy to terminate it. So it kind of makes the point, really. You know, here's a live human being who's lived, and she's actually a Christian, this lady, so that's quite fun and exciting for her as well. And she gave a pretty good testimony on the radio, actually. It was good. Yeah.
Graham?
Yes.
Hasn't abortion now become a financially viable thing for experiments, and they're paying quite a bit of money for these people?
There is... you're not supposed to do it. It's very complicated, but harvesting bodies for body parts is a business, and there's lots of experimental sort of law being thought about to do with could you commodify, is that the right word, make into a commodity body parts from, say, a fetus of sort of early stage. You could harvest various body parts from it, and at the moment I think it's illegal to pay for them or something, but there's a whole process about whether you could do that. And I'm sure, not that we're so amazing in this country, but I'm sure in other countries it is possible, and there is a whole business of that. It's not a fun subject to talk about, is it really? It's quite a sort of serious subject, so I'm going to keep going. I'm assuming you're not interacting because you're just feeling the kind of pain of it. Let's keep going. Does anyone want to say anything? Or should we do part C?
Touch on the consequences for women. Because, I mean, it's interesting the Wade v. Roe case in the States, how the woman in that case, the first abortion case in the States that was taken to court.
Right.
She wanted the right to abort.
Yeah.
She won her case.
Yeah.
Having had her abortion, I think.
Yeah.
But now she's pro-life.
Yeah.
Very interesting how she's switched.
But yeah, I think
women
that's true, actually.
Who have
yeah.
abortions, who don't think it through, who can't think through like we're thinking here, the mental effects are quite bad for them, I think. It's a funny thing to think about.
Yes.
Whether it's worth commenting on or not, I don't know.
No, that's helpful. I cut it out of my notes because there's quite a lot of material, but no, it's good. When in the book it talks about the statistics, it goes on to say that's the statistics in terms of killed babies, but actually there's a much bigger set of statistics to do with women affected in some way, and actually, as we'll see in a moment, men affected too. So that there's a sort of, there's another 200% more going on over here. So there's 9 million, but then there's potentially another
mental issues and a whole
chunk. Another two lots of 9 million that are affected by it as well, the two parents, let alone, you know, other parents and siblings and grandparents and siblings and so on. But in particular, because it's a given and because it's in our culture, it's not as though every woman who's ever had an abortion is kind of necessarily reaping the consequences, but it often is significant. It does have a significant impact on them, because I think we know intuitively what has happened. Let's go on to do part C, because it slightly speaks about that, although it talks about some other issues. I think this is a slightly harder section because it's a bit more conceptual, but it's the thing to do with to do with women's rights. This is a passionate subject, and becoming a bit more so in this country, but certainly in the States, where there was so much rejoicing in Republic of Ireland that the law changed, because it was considered a kind of a human rights issue. So the right of the woman's body, the right of the woman to do what she wants with her body, that was considered like a fundamental human right. So in a way, all the arguments about sort of the fact there's a baby being killed are actually trampled underneath this kind of firmer, stronger, more powerful right, which is the right of the individual who is in a position of power. But I think the book really helpfully raises the question about whether this does actually liberate women at all, or whether it in the end oppresses them for various reasons. And I think it's helpful to kind of at least think about that a little bit. I do mention there that, I kind of mentioned in the introduction as well, that Christianity revolutionized the situation for actually virtually all women, classy or classless women, in Greek-Roman society. There were slaves, and a lot of those were sex slaves for their masters. People of power, at least, would have their wives for maybe having some legitimate children, but other concubines and slaves, both male and female, who they would have for sort of sexual pleasure, and they would be considered sort of different categories. And obviously the product of those liaisons, if it was with someone of the opposite sex, were not wanted because they wouldn't be legitimate children. So there was a terrible oppression of the women themselves, and there were lots and lots of abortions. Again, in the book, there's this horrible fact that archaeologists have found Roman sewers clogged up with the tiny bones of new babies, just kind of thrown away in order to cover up illicit, immoral sexual activity with these kind of exploited women. And what Christianity did was change the situation dramatically, where the husbands were commanded to live with one wife, to not have concubines, not to have prostitutes, not visit prostitutes, not have sex with their slaves, but to be faithful within marriage, sexually faithful, sexually fulfilled within marriage, and a dramatic improvement in the rights of women came along with that, and it actually liberated them. And this is not an easy argument to make, but one could say that the situation we have now with the coming along of both contraception and abortion, it hasn't really provided women with any kind of liberation. It's made them more obligated to have sex, because in a sense there's no excuse, because there's no consequence. It's allowed men to say, well, have sex with me, because there's no consequence to it. So it's taken away, in a way, consequences from both men and women, which hasn't improved the rights of women at all, unless you think that the right to have sex without consequences is some kind of inalienable right that is extremely fulfilling for women. But actually, all the evidence would suggest that women are not fulfilled by that. It's not as though they're going around thinking, this is amazing, I can have sex with whoever I want without consequence. That's not the way we're built, not the way we're wired. In practice, although they might not think about it this way, they're actually just being exploited by men. And then at another sort of level altogether, because of the possibility of contraception and abortion, and the pressure on women to kind of work and be fulfilled in their work, there's often a putting off of having children beyond normal fertile periods. So a lot of kind of having to have children much later in life, and then so needing kind of help in that. Do we want to sort of speak into that at all? I don't know whether you think that's a fair point. I think it's quite a hard point to work, you know, and to be heard in our culture if you start saying that, but...
I guess it backs up the Bible.
Doesn't it? Yeah?
In terms of one man and one woman for life. No sexual morality outside of that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean,
it's
scary.
Yes. Yeah.
Can I just, because I'm the age I am, I've lived through a lot of this.
Yeah.
From the time of 1967 and before. And of course, it was the very shrill thing then to say that it was their right.
Yeah.
It was their right. But the ironic thing is, as Stephen said earlier, there's nothing new under the sun. Because what's happened over the time, because there wasn't the technology then, there is now.
Yeah.
So in India, we now have the technology to decide and find out what the sex is.
Yeah.
Because the ladies, the females, are being aborted because they have the technology.
Yeah.
And of course it was the females who were saying, well, this is our right. But now they're being killed because they're females.
It's happening here in this country. Probably not above the radar, but below the radar. That's why there's a sort of thing within this week's news from the Labour Party being asked to outlaw it. Didn't make it another law to outlaw it happening. But you can't prevent it happening.
Well, so
you can get your test done anywhere in the world.
Yes.
Then say you've got to come here and you want an abortion just for a social reason, you know, you get it justified very easily. So
is it not being spoken that it's perhaps the people from those other countries that are driving this, not English people? We would say the people.
Well, it's all very well pointing the finger at the Asians and saying, well, they're the people that are.
It's their culture.
It's their culture, but don't believe it wouldn't happen in white people, I'm sure it would. Because it can be done, we want it done. Yep. I want designer children, effectively.
Oh, yes, that's the only point.
Yeah. I want a boy, I want a girl. I want the perfect pair, you know.
You've got to remember that we can sit here and be both sad and outraged, but it's the fruit of the kind of poison tree of a whole series of in a sense decisions, influences that our culture has. So it's not as though you know, every person having an abortion is thinking all these things through, but you have to say in the extreme and be outraged to think about it. But it's a harder job then to think how you speak about it with both sensitivity, but also in a way that can be heard and not kind of lost in a kind of a scream about rights or some very obscure argument about one of these viability tests or something like that, or it's just a matter of opinion and those kind of things. So that's something to think about. We'll think about that at the end a little bit.
From a UK point of view, a lot of political campaigns are run on increasing the abortion age and what have you. In the US, Hillary Clinton wanted to raise it right up into a birth age.
Yes.
But from my point of view, when we're, this is probably a side, but when we're looking to support a political party.
Yes.
Every MP will have a different view. How do we follow an MP? We like the party, but how do we support the MP in that? It's, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
No, I understand the question. I do, yeah. I think it's really hard now.
I went to Sam's once about, I think it was to do with embryology. Experimentation. Mm-hmm. You've got another subject there somewhere in the week?
Yeah, well, it's on Talkback actually on Sunday night, but yeah.
The idea of, you know, all the things you can do with DNA testing and so on, and chromosomes and mixing to get embryos and so on, all that sort of stuff. And he was all for it. But, you know, I'm against it because fundamentally we're saying, well, at the point where the sperm and the egg come together, that's life. So you're killing. You're killing in the petri dish. But he didn't want to know about it. What do you do? Who do you vote for? I don't know, it's hard.
I like how Jacob Rees-Mogg at the MP round here. Not that I'm conservative or anything, but he likes to stand up.
Don't be embarrassed if you're conservative. It's not like having a disease.
But do you stop sending your children to school where they're teaching evolution? It's the same principle, you know, where you...
It could be. I suppose, though, that there's a hierarchy, isn't there, to say that we can't legislate for morality. So an MP that is not putting forward a bill that says, you know, you should be stoned if you commit adultery or imprisoned. So there's a hierarchy kind of going up. You could think about homosexuality and think, is it okay for it to be legal or illegal? That's kind of a bit further up. Gay marriage, I think that's a bit further up in terms of the effect it has on society. So you can't legislate for people's moral choices, but whether society positively encourages a particular behaviour is worth thinking about. That was what I was arguing with Tim Farron about, because of the way he voted and abstained in the end. And my argument would be that this is not about giving people the right to. So he would argue you can't morally oblige someone who's not a believer. This is the way our culture is. If they want to live like that and be married, I can't oblige them. I can just preach the gospel. So that could be one argument. My sort of counter-argument is this is so damaging to society. This is society both condoning, almost encouraging legitimizing a behavior which I think is damaging. So because I love people, I wouldn't want to do that. But that's me. I understand the argument, his argument too. But I think there's the right to life is on another level altogether, because it's not about a sort of relative morality. It's about life or death. It's not about behavior. It's about life or death. So I do think it's important in a kind of hierarchy of assessing perhaps an individual MP's behaviour and what you might want to talk to them about.
Did that answer his question?
I don't have a clue. I think it would be what you'd want to talk to them about. It was a long way round.
Who should I vote for?
I'm saying it's one of the most important issues. That's what I'm saying. In a sort of hierarchy of working out, you know, whether you like their economic policy or their morality or what they vote for to do with IVF, I think it gets worse and worse as you sort of work your way out. It's a sort of impossible choice, really. In the States, you vote for someone who's in favour of abortion or just, you know, practice of immorality. In a weird way, God's... anyway, forget that. Carry on.
Just one question that we haven't necessarily really covered, but it's sort of to do with abortion. It's just that if you have a situation where you've got mum and then you've got baby in utero, it's good.
Anencephalic?
I don't know. What does that say?
Bless you.
So it's endangering mum's life, I suppose.
That's sure. That's one example what I gave, but yeah.
Okay. So then you've got the situation...
Anencephalic means it doesn't have a head or it has water on the brain or something. I think that's the right word, isn't it?
No brain.
Okay. Yeah.
So then what do you do? Because you've got the potential to, I suppose, get off the baby to save mum's life.
Sure.
I suppose there is that. I know it's compared to all of these. It's a greyer issue, isn't it? Because you've got both of them. But I know that quite a lot of people would say, "Well, save mum's life."
I think most of us would. Because
I think so. But
at that point, there's very little choice. So what do you do?
I think it is a case by case, though, to do with precisely what the condition is and the relative risks to mum and baby. So I think we wouldn't encourage a sort of an instinctive definitely save the mum and get rid of the baby. I think you'd have to take the best medical information you could to say, so what is the state of the baby? Is it, you know, got no brain, in which case it's never going to survive? You know, we've had friends who have, you know, had babies like that aborted, and we, you know, would support them in it. Where it's completely uncontestable that the baby's not going to survive. But there are other cases where it's a bit more complicated, when there's a sort of blood disorder or, you know, the mum's not doing very well, coping very well or something. It's more of an edge case then, I think. Yeah. One last thing to do with abortion, and then we'll move on and just talk about infanticide and then a few other things. Pardon? Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? But I don't want to sort of poor you for men and so forth, but I think the book makes a good point. It's just worth saying, I've just made a sentence there, but to say that it's not just the women who are affected by it, it is also the rights of men, and the law is skewed in favour of the women's rights, because it's clearly not in favour of the baby's rights, but it also doesn't allow for the man's rights. I think there's no... I don't think there's any right in law for the man to contest an abortion. I don't think there is. And to say that it shouldn't happen... So the men are, in that sense, disenfranchised. I know they're not having to carry the baby, so you could argue, which is what women would argue, but...
Well, it's just, like, assumed that men don't care.
Yeah.
And then, like, affirmed.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's certainly rights to it, isn't it? To a woman, because that's a woman's body, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
They assume they don't have any rights. Well, it's a lot of ignorance, isn't it?
Sure.
Again.
Yeah.
Especially in this day and age, if you're growing up, if you grow up with people telling you, it's your right to do this, it's not your right to do that, how are you to know? If you like, let's just say you're not a Christian, like how are you to know?
Yes.
Or how are you to question these things?
Yeah.
Because like, when I was reading the book, like, I think even I was challenged with the ignorance of, like, you know, I'd there'd be like a big gasp for, like, you know, abortion at 30 weeks. Like, less of a gasp for, like, abortion at, like, 1 week. Mm. And it's like, there shouldn't be that difference. There should be, like, 30 weeks, no. 24 weeks, no. 12 weeks, no. 1 week, no. Like, there should be no in between.
Yeah. Agreed. But also agreed that it's so in the air that we breathe that if you haven't come across that, you kind of put people who are campaigning for the right, you know, pro-life people as in a whole category with just intolerant Christians who are denying women their rights. That's how the argument runs. There isn't any arguments about babies. It's always about the women's rights. And so if that's basically the cultural message, then, you know, why wouldn't you take it on board? And let's be honest, it is hard, if you haven't perhaps thought about it very deeply and you're not particularly into either the science or the morality arguments, it's quite hard to sort of, you know, to be overwhelmingly sort of compelled, particularly, you know, for taking a morning after pill, you know, where the consequences seem very minimal.
It's like it doesn't match up anyway. It's like the law doesn't match up, like it doesn't go with itself anyway. Because I was listening to a podcast about a lady who someone attacked her and she was pregnant. She wasn't very far along. And the baby died,
yeah.
But because there was no law to say that baby was a person who did it couldn't be charged with murder.
Yeah.
It could only be like endangerment or something. And there was uproar about it, saying that you know, was a baby that was, you know, he should go to prison and all the rest of it. And so the judge changed the law, or he made something, because everyone decided that baby was viable. Yet an old baby to go and get like aborted, you know, down the line, that's
yes.
Right. It's like, it doesn't even make sense. Because it was a choice, because she didn't have a choice in it, I guess.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah. You're going to back yourself up. Like, when you have that law, it's like,
Didn't you tell me once that there was a car accident, I'm sure it was you telling me, at a community group once, there was a car accident where a baby was killed, an in utero baby was killed, and there was a court case that decided that the baby, there was manslaughter of the baby as well, or something like that. I think it was in the States. So you get more complicated cases in the States, and that's why you have lots of legal dramas based in the States more than here. Because, but it was you telling me that, wasn't it? Yeah, which was the same inconsistency.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
There was one in Peckham about 4 years ago where the partner attacked his ex-partner in the street, punched her in the stomach repeatedly, and I think they were trying to get him on manslaughter. But I don't know what the outcome was, but it was...
Right.
But obviously
well, it's like you get cases like that and people are all for it. They're like, yeah, that's a baby, that's a life, that, you know, can't do that. And then the next minute they're claiming they're all for women's rights.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to skate through euthanasia, because actually, although it's a different subject, it's kind of the same subject, but just at the other end of life. Then we're going to spend a few moments on biblical principles. Are we all right to go a bit beyond quarter past? If you just want to walk out, just walk out. But I just feel like it needs to probably run till then to allow us to do a little bit of the Bible and a few questions. Right. Euthanasia, which is the word that's not used very much now. The word our culture uses now is mercy killing or assisted dying or dignified dying and all those kind of things. That's the language change that's being brought about. But actually it's the same logic. You know, Katie Hopkins, or is it Kate Hopkins? I don't know. Is quoted as saying this: it's ridiculous that we can put dogs to sleep but not humans. So I went through a process of thinking the puppy I got last week was blind, and I was pondering on if it is actually blind. I don't think it is blind, by the way, but if it was blind, would I put it to sleep? And I was thinking about this as I was walking around in London today, or yesterday on the way up, and I was thinking, you know, would I do that? No, I wouldn't do that. You know, there's a whole process, but in the end, it's more of a emotional decision. It's not a moral decision, I don't think. So I'm not going to put it to sleep. Don't worry about it. Oh, I'm going to love him, whatever. But I think you can see. But it made me think about, so what's the difference? You know, people might be outraged if I put this dog to sleep, but I don't think it's a moral decision, because I don't think it's a person made in the image of God. And you know, if it was blind and deaf and mentally retarded, you probably wouldn't mind if I put it to sleep, would you? But I'd want you to mind if it was a human being. So it's not. It's not the same. Yes.
You didn't care about that dog.
Yeah, even sure.
With all its blindness and whatever.
Yes.
It's a weird society which we did.
Yes.
So the value of the dog is way, way more than the value of the baby or the
people. Which is an irony, but it's almost an overcompensation.
How do we get super bad? I mean, goodness gracious.
Yes. In Holland, which is quite. You haven't even got that far in the book, have you? That. Yeah, in Holland there's basically euthanasia vans, a kind of a mobile euthanasia service, so that would come around to your house and you know, kill off your relative and take them away. And it sounds sort of grotesque and like it's not real, but it is. Now obviously it's not quite as bad as it sounds, because I'm sure there's a process that precedes it, but that's what happens. You know, a van comes around with someone who's able to do that, and then.
How do you argue against that, though? Like, how do you? Because there was a lady who came into the shop, and her mum, she's dead now, but she had like something really wrong with her. She had some sort of disease, and then she became like more like debilitated, and then like she couldn't like feed herself. She couldn't do anything.
Yeah,
and she then had locked-in syndrome, and she was like who were really like strongly telling me how she just wanted her to die and how she ruined her life and not let her mum die. And I like a little bit found myself, I didn't know what to say. I was like, a teeny bit see your point. Like I couldn't argue, I couldn't find reasons other than the obvious of like, you know, God is judge and decides people live and die. I couldn't find like biblical reasons to kind of say that she's still alive.
Yes, and I think it is hard because it's slightly complicated in some cases where life may be sustained by medical intervention in a way that's not realistic. So it does become hard in some edge cases, but I think it is in the end, it's not really an argument that people can buy unless they do take the authority of the Bible. So you can't argue it from some science or logic so much. I think, that would be a better example.
Like, you know, if you really did just, like, leave it, it would die. Isn't that then going back to what that bloke said about babies? Like, if it's not, like, if it's dependent on something, like, if you leave it on your own, then it would just die.
Yeah, I suppose it's not quite the same as that, which is why it's hard. Because it's not exactly the same as that. And that bloke, is not arguing for quite that. There's a whole load of mental things that where the person, if fed, would survive, and cared for, would survive. And it may be in some cases at the end of life where well, particularly I suppose where you've got a breathing machine or some other stimulus that's mechanically making the person stay alive. You could argue then that it's not just a sort of fairly passive medical intervention, it's actually a mechanical means of keeping the person alive in a way that they couldn't possibly. I'm not arguing that it's okay, I'm just saying that those are the edge cases. I think a much better argument against euthanasia, mercy killing in general, is not to do with the really difficult edge cases when someone's in a vegetative state and locked in or whatever else. The argument is much more to do with the logic of this argument is that culture will decide when an older person stops becoming valuable, and this is dangerous for all of you because all of you are going to get old, and if you give away the right to live, you will be killed. That's the perfect logical conclusion of that. If you give away the right to live, you will be killed. Society will eventually start to decide when you need to die. It will be a social construct. Yeah, it will be monetized. It will be a social construct. There will be a whole set of criteria, which means this person no longer lives. On the way to that, there will be pressure on the disabled, the elderly, the generally nuisance people, people who are mentally infirm, who are not contributing much to society. So that's the argument to our friends about that. The logical conclusion is that. I haven't got the quote in front of me. Or maybe I have. Maybe I did keep it open. Basically, disabled people are absolutely scared, witless about this. I think I've got the page 110. Ella French is a, unfortunate word, spunky homeschooled 11-year-old who is currently number 2 ranked professional female wheelchair skater in the world. She regularly dances drop-ins, wheelies, ride the rail and skate park. Did you know that people can use wheelchairs like skateboards performing hair-raising tricks? Did you know that? Don't know. Ella wrote an article, so this is the lady who's in the wheelchair, wrote an article protesting the movie Me Before You. Have you heard of the movie Me Before You? Which is about a young man in a wheelchair who commits assisted suicide. Blah, blah, blah. So she goes on, and then here's the quote. Me Before You is the story of a guy who gets in an accident and has a spinal cord injury and has to spend the rest of his life in a wheelchair. A guy you think should want to die because he has to live a life that looks like mine. This is Ella saying mine. So what's wrong with a life that looks like mine? Ella concludes, you may not believe in God, but I do, and because of that I believe in the value of all people. I believe we're made in his image and likeness. That's why I believe people are worth something. If you believe that people only get their value from each other, then people can take that away. But if our value comes from God, no one has the right to say someone who walks is more worth more than someone who doesn't. So her letter is called Dear Hollywood, Do You Want Me Dead? About herself. This wheelchair lady. So I think that's the stronger argument to your friend, rather than necessarily arguing about the rather obscure kind of medical cases that you might not be able to kind of speak into entirely. Let's just finish this section, then we'll do the last bit. So I'll just rattle these things through from the notes. So just to connect it with personhood theory says that when we lose conscious, deliberate control of our bodies, we can kill the body. It's no longer of use. So you could have a series of tests about, is this person still, do they still have control over their body? So it could start off with complete, you know, mental incapacity, or it could just be that you're incontinent, you know. So, you know, what is the test that says you've lost control over your body? What was fascinating, looking at it from the point of the individual, and I think when I was reading this book, I messaged my family and asked them to guess. So sometime early in the summer, reasons given for wanting to die in a survey, and the top two were 91%. You can tick more than one, which is why the percentages don't add up to 100. So 91% loss of autonomy. That was the top one, loss of control, and then less able to engage in activities. And there is, there's theologically two things to think about. One is the right to life that's embedded in the creation and the command to Noah and so on. So there's the right to life, but there's also the acceptance of God's sovereignty, which I think you were saying, Amy, to do with your friend, but it's, you know, it's a person who came in the shop. It's hard to accept, but that as Christians, we both believe we shouldn't kill somebody because they're made in God's image, but we also accept life can be very difficult, and actually losing control at the end of our life might be God's purpose for us, and it's only really like any other suffering that we have to go through. It's not in some super category of suffering. It's just suffering, and life is difficult, and God will achieve good purposes through it, and it's part of accepting His good purposes that you know, we may disappear into this kind of dark place at the end of our lives, and it might be difficult for our family, but we trust that ultimately in the whole tapestry of life, God is achieving good purposes. So it's not just we obey the command; we also trust the goodness of God. Does that make sense, thinking of those two things? Christian view is that you are a uniquely personal, loved by God person. I put at the bottom there the case of the person in the shop, perhaps artificially prolonging life, not always easy to determine. That, a bit like with the baby mother argument, there are always edge cases where we might have to argue what's a reasonable thing to do. You know, I have known Christians who've had relatives who they've taken. There was this so-called Liverpool method, wasn't there, for a while, that is now out of favour, where you deprive them of food and water, and they die. It's well known, the Liverpool method, and I've known Christians who've been told this is what the hospital is going to do, just going to make their sort of, you know, grandmother comfortable or whatever, and they have died. I'm extremely uncomfortable with that. But you know, it's difficult. My mum says, if I'm dead, don't resuscitate me. And I say, no, we'll just celebrate. No, I say, well, it depends, Mum. I know it's slightly different if they're dead, but I say it's different, Mum. It depends what you die of exactly, and you know what. I'm not sure I want to keep your wishes about that because it depends. Yeah, but it wasn't even as simple as do not resuscitate. It was. She had a sort of, you know, another set of scenarios as well.
There's a complication, because that's actually where our ability to supposedly improve life in the older age group now.
Yeah.
So with stents and all that sort of stuff. So you can improve the physical, say the heart, but you can't actually then help the brain, and the brain goes before the heart goes in. So you've actually created a bigger problem for yourself, literally, than you had before. Because if it hadn't interfered, then nature would have taken the forces in the way. Very difficult arguments.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's all right. Biblical view of life is there on the notes, but I'm just going to whiz through it. I'm going to whiz through it in 2 or 3 minutes, and then we're going to have the last few minutes. Genesis 9 verse... I was trying to work out what was going on there. Genesis 9 verse 6 says, "Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made mankind." This is considered a foundational text that actually mandates society to protect life. It actually legitimizes societies, as in state authorities protecting life. This is like a foundational text in the Bible about that. But it says that we shouldn't shed human blood, whether it's in the womb or in a hospital bed somewhere very, very unwell. We shouldn't shed human blood because they're made in God's image and they have a dignity which is beyond their biological makeup. So that's a foundational text to do with the right to life in general. And then there's lots to do with Exodus 20 verse 13, which is "you shall not kill." What do you think Psalm 139 says, to save me looking it up? It says that as well. But what else? Yeah, knit together in my mother's womb. So there's a sense in Psalm 139 that... what does he say? A personal pronoun. Is that the word? Me? You knit me together in my mother's womb. It wasn't you knit something together which eventually became me. Me was there in my mother's womb. There's a me. It's a really important text for personifying the knit together conceived child in the womb. There's something similar in Job 31. There's other things. I'll just find Job 31 very quickly. Job 31, 15. That's all right, you just go through. Well, it's jolly inconvenient. It's going to be one at a time again. Why don't they all just line up and come through at the same time? Job 31 verse 15 says, "Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers?" It's a really good text, isn't it? Because it's really clear that there's the formation of a person within the mother's womb. There's something similar in Isaiah and in Jeremiah. Jeremiah just happens to be talking about his own kind of ministry in Jeremiah, but still, it's the same point being made about a sort of prenatal. That's a fancy word, isn't it? A prenatal existence. Why do you think there's a quotation from Luke 1:41? What's going on in there? I think it is. Quite so.
That's not a wrong thing, is it? Because people will accept the fact that you can, you know, play music and all sorts of things well and enjoy your pregnancy can actually have a beneficial effect on the fetus. So, funny thing, that. It's not yet up with us.
Yeah, so the significance of that is... as you say, that there's a description that the baby has a kind of a prenatal existence. It's the baby that leaps and is given a name as well and so forth. So those are some of the sort of foundational texts. I did want to read Jeremiah because I just looked at it and thought how good it was. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart, anointed you as a prophet to the nations. Now that's a particular thing to do with the calling of Jeremiah, but it's also very interesting that it says what the other texts say, which is that the person is formed in the womb, but it also says it's actually, you're actually kind of trying to mess with God's plan in terminating a pregnancy. In that God has a plan, particularly for Jeremiah and his calling as a prophet, but there's a kind of continuum of before that. So, those are the texts. My concluding things, which I want to do in the last few minutes, is to keep remembering the gospel, that the gospel tells us how to live, and hopefully... I haven't spent a long on the biblical arguments because I think you would probably understand and agree with them. But the gospel tells us how to live, but also rescues us when we fail to live the way we're supposed to. That's really important. To keep remembering that for those, for ourselves, or for people we minister, for people we talk to, for people we witness to, this is not an unforgivable sin. To have been involved in the euthanasia of a relative or in an abortion or in something else or involved in IVF or any of those things. We're not to suddenly become inconsistent about the gospel and say, we wouldn't like people like that in our church or something like that. It's to be completely consistent and say that Jesus died for all our pride and lust and stealing and actually terminating lives. That's what Jesus died for. Paul himself, the apostle, was a murderer. As I think I quoted the other week, some of us as staff went to see John Newton's church and remember that he was a murderer and almost certainly kind of raped slaves and so forth. And you kind of stand in his church and you think he wrote Amazing Grace and he understood grace. So you've got to keep remembering that it's not about judging people. So in any words we're saying, we're trying to bring them to a point where sure, they might need to understand that something they've done is wrong, but absolutely they need to understand that whatever they've done and whatever you've done and whatever I've done can be forgiven at the cross, because grace is amazing. So just keep remembering the gospel. Number two, keep remembering we're not imposing our views on people as some kind of arbitrary morality. What we're trying to do is protect human rights. So our argument is not we don't care about women. Our argument is we care about babies and we're trying to protect their rights. The argument is that we think, you know, people should die with complete indignity. Now, we're not saying that. We're just saying we care about all lives, and we think we should do all we can to preserve life for as long as God allows it. There may be edge cases, there may be difficult judgments to make, but in the end, our default is to seek to preserve life, and that actually is a good thing for the whole of society, or we're all subject to the state killing us off. And that's the kind of, I think, the big argument for that. So I think we should also, as campaigners, speak up for anything that moves towards less terminations, earlier terminations, protects people at the end of their lives, because people are made in the image of God. Right, got 5 minutes for any questions, or you can just go if you want. But if you've got any questions or anything else you want to say.
I think it's important to be compassionate. Mm-hmm. And not judgmental. It's easy to get judgmental, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's very helpful, your last point, that we should campaign for the human rights, but of course our definition of human rights is somewhat different to the EU definition, or even the
Just read a very interesting book recommended by Pam Howard called Being Mortal, and it's not a Christian book, and the chap who wrote it is an Indian descent, an Indian surgeon in America. No, it's not a view, it's just the whole thrust of the book is all about end-of-life care.
All right, okay.
End-of-life care. And...
Pardon?
I thought you were done. I'm sorry. No. I apologize.
I'm sorry, Roger, I couldn't cope with... I was coping quite well with one lot of people streaming, but someone else in my other ear, I couldn't cope anymore, sorry.
It's a very sad book, because it doesn't have a Christian perspective, but... and an even sadder ending, really. But he's dealing with the issue of end-of-life care and how badly the mainstream do it. They've got better, and pointed out how badly we do it here. Example, I can think of example, of court. We put them in there, you know, and just institutionalised them, and then they die. But... he was saying that from a surgical point of view, and he gave quite a few practical examples about how it's possible when someone is very seriously ill towards the end of their life. There's lots that we can do now with technology,
yes,
with the medical sciences that we have, to prolong people's lives.
Yeah.
But it's not always the best answer to go through that process. Sometimes it's better for the patient to let, as we said earlier, nature take its course, and for them to pass away without prolonging their life and perhaps making their suffering worse. That's not a euthanasia issue, but it's just talking through the practical of how people are treated right at the end of their lives when they're seriously ill.
Yes.
Like going through cancer treatment after cancer treatment after cancer treatment. When you hear people say, like, I just said this.
Sure. Those are difficult judgments, absolutely. And in that sense, you may be ending life, because you may take a relative judgment about quality of life, and I understand that. But that's
something that's actually in us. It's part of our makeup, is the fact the desire to live.
Oh, yes.
We don't want to die.
Yes, that's it. Came through very much in the book. Yes.
There's a passionate desire in our society to keep young, and how long can you live for, and so on. Whiskey a day keeps.
And he goes to very practical examples of how people were put into a situation and were declining, but because they changed the scenario, gave them a better situation, apartment, more interaction with other people, people visiting, doing activities, people's quality of life actually got better.
Yeah.
Although they're dying, but they got better at the end because of the way they structured it.